Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana, where it is cool but a beautiful day. The sun is all out there and a few clouds, but not many. And I don't mind that as long as the sun comes out. I just get tired of when it rains, man. Affects my psyche, man. I tell you. Hey, it's October the 23rd, 2014, Thor's Day. That's right. I like Thor's Day because, Thor's Day is getting close to Friday, and thank God it's Friday. I don't know why I would say that, because I don't have a super schedule to make here. Every day is about like the next day, because we're doing a radio show every day, or almost every day. And that keeps me busy, plus yard work and my bird feeding and letter writing and emailing and program making and website helping with the webmaster. Oh, man, I'm busier now than when I was living in California. I can't believe it. But today we've got something that I recorded during the night, which I think is absolutely essential for you to understand. You know, I'm always talking down major domos and super leaders. Well, there's a reason for that. It's because with power, many times becomes arrogance. And with arrogance comes mistakes. And the higher you get in the system, the more prone you are to use that power wrongly. And we're on during the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's some new stuff has come out which scares me today, even after all these years. I remember it quite well. I had a couple of friends on destroyers headed for Cuba at that time during that crisis. And fortunately, it never came about. But we came within a hair's breadth of atomic war. And the problem is that when you have super powerful men in power, even due to mistakes and so forth, they're liable to use that power and press the trigger. And I don't know. People were scared at that time, but they were getting a lot of false bullshit information, too. The trouble is you can never believe the press or the president or anybody else totally, no matter what you think. Now, we'll start out this thing once I get her going here, but remember what started the whole damn thing. Oh, you don't remember? The military-industrial complex that put ICBMs all around Russia, had them down in Turkey and all over the place. And Russia says, hey, get rid of those damn ICBMs. And they were pretty close to Russia. And the hawks in Washington, oh, no, we're going to keep them there, God damn it. And so Khrushchev says, well, fuck these people. I'm going to put ICBMs in Cuba with my buddy Castro. And Castro was ready, willing, and able because he was scared to death of being attacked like the Bay of Pigs, only for earnest. This whole idea of almost a war with Castro over the fact that he wanted socialism, communist socialism in Cuba, it's none of our business. I mean, it's our business to know what's going on, but it's not our business to go all around the world and crush people who don't want to live the same way we do. So here you got Castro, who's paranoid as hell, and he's also a little bit of a psychopath. You got Nikita Khrushchev, who actually didn't do that much wrong. In fact, if it wasn't for Khrushchev, there would have been an atomic war. Yeah. don't give all this credit to Kennedy, because Kennedy had plenty of people around him that were ready to go to war right now. So anyhow, I'm going to run this for you. And I hope you understand that the reason we need leaderless resistance is because leaders can't be trusted. There's no president of the United States. Look at what happened. We trusted Wilson. And what did he do? He drug our men over to Europe and got them killed by the tens of thousands. Look at England. They never saw a war they didn't want to get into. What, a million guys died in one battle? The Kaiser and all these people were somewhat psychopaths. Because when these people become super powerful and they got the weapons, they're going to use them sooner or later. Look at what happened in Germany. There didn't need to be the Second World War. Did not need to be a Second World War at all. And look at what's happened after the Second World War. And then we just keep having these wars in Vietnam and Korea and so forth. So you can't trust powerful leaders. And sometimes they're not even super powerful. So I prefer to be just a little old Tom Metzger here and not be some big shot. Because big shots make mistakes. Sometimes it's horrible things that they do, and they make mistakes. But that's all. You'll find a whole lot of people, you know, even in our struggle, want to get that power, man. If I had that power, I'd do this and I'd do that. Mm-hmm. Well, think it over. How old were you when the Cuban Missile crisis? And it was a crisis, I'm telling you. We, like I say, we escaped by the hair of our chinny chin chin on that one. But it'll happen again, because you got psychopaths in the governments, the leaders. Almost all of them are psychopaths, if not all of them. And then, of course, too, they get the people mesmerized into following along with them. Oh, the president says, well, we may have to go to war. Oh, yeah, let's go to war, you know. So you can't let the people off the hook. But I think the small government's the only way to go, somewhat of an anarchist type thing, where you don't have these super leaders that tend to get corrupt and rotten like they all do. No matter how great you think they were, years later when the truth comes out, you find out what rats they are.
Professor James Blight about the Cuban Missile Crisis and what was happening in Havana, Washington, and Moscow 5 decades ago. On October 14, 1962, an American U-2 spy plane on a reconnaissance flight over western Cuba gathered the first photographic evidence of Soviet missile installations. 8 days later, congressional leaders saw the photos and President Kennedy addressed the nation.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. Upon receiving the first preliminary hard information of this nature, last Tuesday morning at 9 a.m., I directed that our surveillance be stepped up. And having now confirmed and completed our evaluation of the evidence and our decision on a course of action, this government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail.
You know, one of the interesting things about this event is that Khrushchev almost got away with it. It came very, very close, because in the Caribbean, this is the storm season. This is the hurricane season. Cloud cover moved in over Cuba. U-2s flying at 75,000 feet could see nothing. And so for days and even for several weeks off and on, they couldn't get decent intelligence, aerial intelligence, of what was going on in Cuba. Now, there's something else to be said here, which is that they had a lot of on-the-ground intelligence because, I mean, Fidel had a lot of his Cubans in Miami telling him what the CIA maybe was up to, and likewise, the U.S. government had a lot of spies in Cuba. It's really interesting to note that the CIA, the Anglo handlers of the Cubans that were infiltrating the island, they would bring back what turns out to be absolutely pinpoint information about missiles that are this long and particular kinds of equipment that should have rung all the bells, but they discounted it. You can't trust the Cubans. We don't know if they're Cubans or are Cubans. So all we can really trust is the technology. But unfortunately, the technology was flying too high to take the pictures. So on the 14th, the critical pictures finally are taken because the cloud cover lifts for a bit. 15th, they're analyzed. 16th, Kennedy finds out, and they call the first meeting of his group later that morning.
Now, who were the other hawks and doves? What about McNamara? What about Dean Rusk? What about the president's kitchen cabinet?
Yeah. Kennedy's reaction, 11:30 a.m., October 16th, 1962. Kennedy, just before lunch, he says, "We're going to talk about three things this afternoon. The first thing we're going to talk about is the thing I know we're going to do, and that's bomb the missile sites. The second thing we're going to have to discuss is that going to be enough, or do we have to bomb all the Soviet installations all over the island? That's the second thing. And the third thing is that going to be enough, or are we going to have to mount a full land, sea, and air invasion of the island of Cuba? So, have a good lunch, but we're going to war tonight, and it's a question of what kind of war we're going to. I'll see you in a couple hours." They come back, and what you get is, this is totally polarizing. The hawks become more hawkish, the doves become more... And Kennedy immediately says, when they come back, "I think we should ask what the Soviet reaction would be to any of these acts." And that puts the brakes on everything. And it's at that point, I really believe at that point, that he begins to invest heavily in McNamara. McNamara is going to have to manage these guys over at the Pentagon. He knows what these guys want to do. They want to go for it. They can't believe we didn't go for it in 1961 when they had a chance at the Bay of Pigs, and the Navy is waiting 2 miles offshore, and somehow or other this president of ours said, no, afraid of escalation. Well, he's doing it again. Well, McNamara's going to have to manage them. So basically, whenever Kennedy leaves the room, and he leaves the room a lot because he wants a conversation to go on without him there, and then he wants to know what they said. And it's usually McNamara who, with his, you know, he's like a bull in a china shop, says, "Oh, I'm in charge now," and he pounds his left fist down, and everybody kind of backs off. And then they line up the options, McNamara style, and then the president comes in, and then McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, says, "Well, we have a range of views. We have some people who think we need to go in, and some people," so on and so forth. So it goes on like this for 6 days, and the secret was kept.
On October 27, 1962, known as Black Saturday, an American U-2 spy plane was shot down over Cuba, killing the pilot, Major Rudolph Anderson. Professor James Blight says that 12th day of the Cuban Missile Crisis was as close as the United States and the Soviet Union would come to outright war with each other.
When word got back in the mid-afternoon to the XCOM, many of the people said, "Oh, that the war's begun. We know that the Soviets are in charge of the surface-to-air missiles, the only kind that can shoot the U-2s down at that height. That must mean Khrushchev wants it." It's unbelievable, but it seems like he's ready to escalate. He's going to push this all the way to the limit. He's ready to go to war over Cuba, and I think we have to prepare to go to war over Cuba. And what that meant in the context of the time almost certainly was, we have to strike first. Otherwise, there's no chance of surviving this. If we strike first, and we're lucky, and we hit most of the targets, it may disarm the Soviet Union in what was then called by Curtis LeMay a disarming first strike, or a splendid first strike. So within a matter of minutes, after learning that this single spy plane had been shot down over Cuba, people are actually talking about going to war with the Soviet Union. They're, you can hear that they're confused. McNamara says, wait a minute, I have a list here of 12 or maybe 13 things we can do short of going to war. Let's try a few of these. I don't think we should jump into this. I don't think we'll be able to control it. Other people are saying, oh, no, come on. What more evidence do you need than a dead American serviceman? We can't even send our reconnaissance people over Cuba because they're unarmed and they're going to get shot down increasingly. Furthermore, and this is one of the trigger points or tipping points, I think, the cloud cover moved back in, and Kennedy, after the 22nd, during that week leading up to the 27th, is sending in every day dozens and dozens of pairs of these F-8 Vought Crusaders flying 600 miles an hour at 50 feet off the ground, fitted out with these amazing cameras that take high-resolution pictures. And what this looks like on the ground is a totally different story. These are planes that make buildings explode. These are planes that blow out windows. And the Soviets have told the Cubans, you may not shoot at them. You can. I know you got your guns out there. You guys have got the guns that hit the low-level planes, but don't use them because the damn war could start. And the Cuban reaction is, it started. The war's been going on for months. I mean, cut it out. So Castro goes out on the afternoon of the 26th. Two of these planes fly over. He looks at his crew. He goes right back to his headquarters and said, screw the Russians. Shoot them down. I want everything that you can hit. I want it down. I want all these planes down. And it was like a contagion all across the island. People are cheering and celebrating when they hear that this U-2 has been brought down. Now, it's true that the Russians brought it down, but the reason that happened is that the Cubans said to the Russians, are you going to play this game or aren't you? Are you going to get off your hands and shoot these guys? Or what are you going to... You're going to be just as dead as we are, aren't you? Well, it was contagious. I mean, they finally felt a kind of sense of empowerment that they had lost because these low-level planes are so fast, so loud, and so humiliating to them. So, we get to the 27th. One of the planes is shot down. The Americans are thinking that Khrushchev wants to go to war. Khrushchev is thinking, wow, Khrushchev knows what Kennedy's thinking. He's thinking, I'm thinking, I want to go to war. Holy cow, no. Well, final piece of the puzzle, Fidel Castro. Late in the evening, it's actually early in the morning of the 27th. It begins at 3 a.m. and it ends at 7 a.m. He goes into a bunker underneath the Soviet embassy, the bomb shelter, with the Soviet ambassador, Alexander Alexeyev. Castro says, I have to write one more letter to Comrade Nikita, and I need your help working it out. Castro obviously didn't speak Russian. Alexeyev spoke pretty good Spanish, but they had another interpreter there. They go through 10 drafts. And Castro is really getting aggravated. He can't quite say what he wants. Finally, Alexeyev says to him, these are in his cables, which we now have, Alexeyev's cables, are you saying that you want us to attack the United States of America with nuclear weapons? Is that what you're asking? Castro says, yes, but not exactly, not quite. If, he says, if they attack us, and invade us and occupy us. And then he says, I know this one by heart. That would be the moment to eliminate this danger forever, for there is no other solution. Alexeyev goes out to a side room while Castro is fuming and fussing over a draft. He then sends a message on the KGB channel. It goes immediately to Khrushchev, and it says, in case you're confused about what this letter is saying that's about to be sent, what it says is, wipe them off the face of the earth. That is his request. That is a suicide request. That is the last request of a man who is more than willing to take his 6.5 million countrymen down with him, because this will be the moment to eliminate the United States Empire forever.
And Khrushchev thought, no, I don't think so.
Khrushchev, when this is, he's in a tense meeting. A guy comes to the door and says, something just came in from Fidel. And then he reads the thing from Alexeyev. Wipe them off the face of the earth. Khrushchev stands straight up in his chair and shouts, this is insane. Fidel is trying to drag us with him into the grave. He wants to die beautifully, and he wants us to die beautifully right along with him. Okay, this is what we're going to do. The missiles are coming out. Nobody does anything on the island of Cuba unless my signature is on the piece of paper that orders it. We are done, finished, out of here. That's it. That moment is so tense that it's easy to imagine one plane being shot down, one more plane, one low flyer, one U-2, because they're still flying over the island. What happens if one or two of those planes come down? I think they have to respond. They're going to either have to stop the flights and not know whether these missiles are operational, which is not acceptable, or they're going to have to bomb the crap out of them because they can't, in good conscience, send in unarmed photographic planes knowing that the enemy is trying to shoot them down. And that's totally unacceptable. So the war could have started at any moment, probably in a 12-hour period between late Saturday the 27th and early Sunday the 28th.
How is this, or is this, remembered in Cuba? Is it taught in schools?
Yeah, it's called the October Crisis. The older generation of Cubans thinks of this as almost some kind of primal moment. There are pieces of the U-2 that were shot down all over the island, and the chunks of it are in these little circular gravel pits. They have a little kind of border around them. They're sort of like religious relics, and they prove to the Cubans that we are on our own, and we don't mind being on our own, and we can protect ourselves. So, Yankees, just listen up. Just one last point on this. The first time my wife Janet and I were ever in Cuba was in 1989. We went to see the main carcass of the U-2, which is the second holiest relic in Cuba after the Granma, the ship that Castro and his colleagues came from Mexico on in 1955. We stepped back because a bunch of school children approached. A teacher is giving a lecture and keeps pointing to this metal object over here. And at one point, this was really spooky, because she put her fist in the air, and all these students put their little tiny fists in the air, and they shouted, Patria o Muerte, Fatherland or Death. And I thought, whoa, 8 years old, and they're already getting ready for another one of these ultimate confrontations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. And they're already getting ready for another one of these ultimate confrontations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Professor James Blight is an expert on the Cuban Missile Crisis. With his wife and fellow researcher Janet Lang, Blight wrote a book and produced a transmedia project about the crisis called The Armageddon Letters. You can find links and more information at our website, BobEdwardsRadio.com.
An American journalist and the KGB station chief in Washington.
A reporter for ABC News called John Scali, who later became U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was meeting with a Soviet official who turned out to be the KGB station chief in Moscow, a man called Fekhristov. Together they met in various restaurants around town and hatched a plan to save the world from nuclear war. Scali convinced the Kennedy administration that this was a back channel to Khrushchev. In fact, Khrushchev was completely unaware of what Fekhristov was doing, and Fekhristov was probably just kind of fishing for information in the traditional KGB manner, and his signals were misinterpreted by Scali. Whether Scali just exaggerated his own role, or whether he really believed that this was an important channel, I don't know. But what I do know is that, contrary to the myth and to many missile crisis histories, particularly the early ones, it played virtually no role in the final outcome.
And then there was the legendary moment when a Soviet freighter came eyeball to eyeball with American warships and the Soviets blinked.
Right, for any of your listeners who have seen the movie 13 Days, this is features prominently in the movie. Of you actually see the Soviet ships come within sight of the American warships, and the American warships threatening to blow them out of the water, and Kennedy actually on the line from the White House deciding at the last moment not to attack because the Soviet ships have turned around. I think I'm the first researcher who's actually plotted where the Soviet ships were and where the American ships were at the time, and Khrushchev had taken the decision to turn his ships around the previous day. So at the time of the eyeball-to-eyeball moment, as depicted in many missile crisis histories and by Hollywood, about 800 miles of water separated the two navies at that point, and the Soviet ships were headed, or at least the Soviet ships that were carrying missiles, were headed back to the Soviet Union.
There's generally a lot of confusion during the crisis, and you take the long view on it when you say that history is determined not just by the so-called rational actors, like the bureaucrats and generals, but also the irrational actors, people who stumble onto the stage by chance and change the course of history. And U2 pilot Chuck Maltsby became one of the latter. What was his story?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that the real risk of war did not come from this direct confrontation between Khrushchev and Kennedy, as symbolized by the eyeball-to-eyeball moment. I think it came from the kind of accidents, unpredictable events that happen almost automatically as soon as you gear up your military machine for war. And a very good example of this was the U-2 mission of Captain Maltsby on October 27th, which became known around the White House as Black Saturday. It was probably the day we became closer to nuclear war than either before or since. And essentially the story is that the Soviets had been testing in the atmosphere. We had routine missions to the North Pole to pick up radioactive samples from the Soviet nuclear tests, which had drifted up to the North Pole from the Soviet nuclear test site. Captain Maltsby was meant to go to the North Pole, collect the samples, and return to Alaska. Instead, he's about 4 or 5 hours out from Alaska when he gets blinded by the Aurora Borealis. And in those days, of course, the navigation systems in planes and U-2s was much cruder than it is these days. They had to navigate by the stars. You couldn't see the stars. So instead of going back to Alaska, he takes a wrong turn somehow, and instead of at the time when he should be back landing at Alsen Air Force Base, he is blundering over the Soviet Union on the most dangerous day of the Cold War. He spends 1.25 hours over in Soviet airspace, and I've traced his route in detail. Actually runs out of fuel and has to glide back to Alaska. The whole story of how the Strategic Air Command identifies where he is and how they get him back is, you know, quite a long saga. But the essential point is that Kennedy and the Pentagon hierarchy didn't even know that this mission was going on at the time. It's one of these kind of unpredictable events, like during the Kosovo War, we had the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And point is, once you go to war, these many things that you never expected can start to happen, and some of them can be very dangerous. And the Maltsby case is an example of that.
And on the Soviet side, you point to the commander of one of the four submarines sent into the region as a show of strength and protection for the freighters carrying arms to Cuba.
That's right. And although I said that the Soviet ships turned back, at least the missile carrying ships, Khrushchev left four submarines in the vicinity of the American blockade, and these weren't ordinary submarines. They were armed with nuclear warheads. Conditions on those submarines were terrible. It had taken them about 3 or 4 weeks to get there. Conditions, it's hard to imagine American sailors putting up with the kind of conditions that the Soviets put up with. Their normal air conditioning systems had failed. It was 140 degrees inside the subs, and they had nuclear weapons to defend themselves. The Americans spent a lot of time tracking down these subs and trying to bring them to the surface, which they did by dropping depth charges on them. Of course, the submarine captains had no idea whether they were depth charges or what was going on up there. And at one point on one of the subs, there's a discussion as to whether or not to use the torpedoes against the American destroyer, the nuclear torpedo, against American destroyer who's making their life intolerable. And they're trapped down below, hundreds of feet below the surface of the ocean, not knowing what's happened above, not knowing whether a nuclear war has broken out.
So what happened on the climactic day? This was October 27th, 1962.
Well, a lot of things were happening on the on this particular day. Originally, I set out to describe in detail just or reconstruct this particular day, because I wanted to describe, you know, the day the world came closest to nuclear annihilation. It begins with Fidel Castro convinced that the Americans are about to attack his country, going to the Soviet embassy in Cuba in the middle of the night at 2 in the morning, writing a letter, a feverish letter to Khrushchev saying, I'm convinced we're about to be attacked, in which case you should use your nuclear weapons against the imperialists and liquidate the imperialists once and for all. He had a rather grandiose idea of the strength of the Soviet nuclear force at that time. So you had Fidel urging Khrushchev to use nuclear weapons. You also had, at the same time, the Soviet commander on Cuba, General Pliev, decided to disperse his nuclear warheads. So they had decided that they would, the first thing they would do if there was an attack on Cuba was they would take out Guantanamo. So they brought up tactical nuclear missiles, cruise missiles, each with a warhead the size of a Hiroshima bomb, 14 kiloton bomb, to the periphery of the Guantanamo naval base. Maltsby got lost over the Soviet Union. Another U-2 reconnaissance plane got shot down by the Soviets over Cuba, probably because the Soviets feared that they had discovered their plans for the attack on Guantanamo. Khrushchev sent another letter to Kennedy appearing to up the ante for a deal. He wanted an exchange of Soviet missiles in Cuba for American missiles in Turkey, which was unacceptable. At least a public exchange was unacceptable to Kennedy. At sea in the Caribbean, these depth charges were being dropped on Soviet submarines. So you had at least half a dozen incidents in different parts of the world, any one of which could have resulted in something much more serious. And one of the things that it really struck me was that a president, no matter how well informed he is, cannot possibly keep track of all these things at once. You know, Kennedy only knew half of what was going on. There was so much that he didn't know.
I wonder how much Khrushchev knew.
Well, Khrushchev knew even less, because he had his communications with Cuba and his troops on Cuba were much more basic and cruder than the U.S. communication system with their troops. So, and certainly he had no physical control over the nuclear weapons. There were no locks on the weapons. And that's one of the myths that I've sought to dispel, that somehow the commanders-in-chief had control over their own forces. It wasn't true. Command and control are two different things. The commander cannot possibly control everything that happens by his own forces.
And yet they stopped it. It wasn't, you know, you had this big dance going on, but...
That's right. Well, remember that both men had been through, experienced the Second World War, and Khrushchev in particular had seen incredible devastation in his own country, and he did not want to go through that again. And he knew that a conventional war was bad enough. And Kennedy as well. He had a sense of the chaotic forces of history, and he knew that he was losing control of events on Saturday. So he was willing to go very far to prevent a nuclear war. So by the Saturday, this culmination of all these events, I think, convinced both leaders that they had to bring the crisis to an end very rapidly, because otherwise something unpredictable could happen.
Did they have the red phone hotline at that time?
They didn't. The hotline between the Kremlin and the White House was only installed after the crisis, partly, largely as a result of the crisis. It took 12 hours to get a message from Washington to Moscow, because the former Soviet ambassador to Washington, Anatoly Dobrynin, he tells a story about how they would try to send messages back to Moscow in the middle of the missile crisis, and they would, first of all, they'd have to encode the message, encrypt it in essentially gibberish to anybody else who was reading, and they would write it up in a telegram. They would call Western Union on DuPont Circle. A messenger from Western Union would arrive on a bicycle. He would pick up the precious message from the Soviet embassy and bicycle off, and the Soviet diplomats would see the Western Union messenger bicycling off with their message, trying to defuse a war, and just hope that he wouldn't stop off to chat with his girlfriend or something on the way. Then the message was sent by cable, transatlantic cable, to London, and eventually it would you know, reach the Kremlin and have to be deciphered. And that process took about 10 to 12 hours often.
So the worst day of the Cold War comes to an end. Khrushchev agrees to take the missiles out. And the Cold War continues for another 30 years.
From 1962 to, I guess, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. That's true. And I think that the missile crisis was, it was a turning point in many ways, because it was the last time that both sides really thought that, certainly on the American side, that it was possible to win a nuclear war. The Americans enjoyed great strategic advantage at the time of the missile crisis, and there were people who, like LeMay, who thought you could wage and win a nuclear war. During the 60s, there was a massive Soviet buildup, and the two sides became much more equal. So all thought of winning a nuclear war went out the window.
So what do you think of Defense Secretary Robert McNamara's later belief that only luck kept the world from nuclear war over Cuba?
I think there was a large element of luck, but I think it was more than luck, because I think a lot depended on the personalities involved, in particular the personalities of Khrushchev and Kennedy. And although Kennedy made many mistakes, and particularly in his Cuba policy, had been quite provocative to the Russians, when the chips were down, he had everything that could go wrong, partly because he had had his World War II experience. So he understood that things like a U-2 could go missing over the Soviet Union, and he kind of factored that into his decision-making, and it was one of the reasons why on Black Saturday he was willing to go to considerable lengths, including withdrawing U.S. missiles from Turkey, to reach an accommodation with Khrushchev. And one thing we didn't know at the time was that it only came out many years later, was that the Bobby Kennedy went to the Soviet embassy on the night of Black Saturday and said, we will, after a certain time, withdraw our missiles from Turkey if you withdraw your missiles from Cuba. That deal never became public until 30 or 40 years later.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to be here and great to discuss this with you.
Michael Dawes.
Live from the White House in Washington, the Mutual Broadcasting System brings you an address by President John F. Kennedy. All during the weekend, there has been an atmosphere of crisis here in Washington. Congressional leaders met with the President at 5 o'clock this afternoon. Now, with a report to the people, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
Next, a transmedia. In October of 1962, human civilization came as close as it ever has to destroying itself. NATO had placed nuclear missiles in Turkey and Italy and pointed them at the Soviet Union. Moscow decided to even the playing field by placing its own missiles in Cuba, just 100 miles from the southern coast of the United States. If President John F. Kennedy and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev had not resolved their 13-day confrontation, known here as the Cuban Missile Crisis, the resulting nuclear war could have meant the deaths of hundreds of millions of people. After a week of considering his options, Kennedy addressed the nation in what has been called the scariest speech ever given by a president.
My fellow citizens, let no one doubt that this is a difficult and dangerous effort on which we have set out. No one can foresee precisely what course it will take, or what costs or casualties will be incurred. Many months of sacrifice and self-discipline lie ahead, months in which both our patience and our will be tested, months in which many threats and denunciations will keep us aware of our dangers. But the greatest danger of all would be to do nothing. The path we have chosen for the present is full of hazards, as all paths are. But it is the one most consistent with our character and courage as a nation and our commitments around the world. The cost of freedom is always high, but Americans have always paid it. And one path we shall never choose, and that is the path of surrender or submission. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere, and we hope around the world. God willing, that goal will be achieved.
Although it's one of the most decisive chapters in human history, the lessons of the Cuban Missile Crisis are lost on many. The history is hazy to young people and widely misunderstood by those who lived through it. But James Blight has done his best to change that. Blight has employed his captivating brand of scholar meets storyteller in a transmedia history project about the crisis called The Armageddon Letters. First, I asked Professor Blight just how close we came to nuclear war in October of 1962.
I think we came very close, Bob. I don't think we need to consult science fiction anymore or apocalyptic movies, interesting though they may be, because the three leaders most directly involved, Fidel Castro, John F. Kennedy, and Nikita Khrushchev, all thought that events were racing out of control and that war was about to break out and that they might not be able to stop it. This is especially true of Kennedy and Khrushchev because they're in charge of these huge nuclear arsenals. Fidel Castro has a somewhat different tale to tell in that he had concluded months before this, 18 months before this, that Cuba was on a trail toward oblivion, that Kennedy would destroy the Cuban government, and that an American attack would involve nuclear weapons. This is long before any nukes were put in Cuba, and that therefore his job as a leader was to prepare the Cuban population to die honorably and, in effect, to commit national suicide, and in so doing, become the salvation of world socialism. That Cuba, instead of being this little podunk nothing, as it had been for so many years, a playground for Americans, rich Americans, Cuba would now become, and this is one of Fidel's phrases, Cuba would become the hinge of the world.
There's a generally accepted narrative of the Cuban Missile Crisis. 13 tense days of negotiation. Khrushchev finally backs down. Kennedy's a hero. What do you challenge in that narrative?
The way we like to tell the standard story is that bad guys put missiles into an empty island where nobody lived, that had no culture, language, or history. We call it Cuba. They parked their missiles there for a few days before the courageous president faced him down and forced him to take them back to the Soviet Union. In sports terms, that would be Kennedy 1, Khrushchev 0, and for basketball fans, Castro gets a DNP for did not play. None of that's actually true. What happened in those 13 days is roughly 2% of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That began in April 1961 with the Bay of Pigs invasion, after which both Khrushchev and Castro concluded that the big invasion, not just sending in the exiles, but the really big invasion, the Marines, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, all of that would be coming as soon as Kennedy could muster his troops around Cuba.
So what's new to write about this?
Well, with my wife and colleague Janet Lang, we've written 6 books on these so-called 13 days, the Cuban Missile Crisis, published our 7th book, The Armageddon Letters, and what our main purpose was in getting involved again would be to try to produce something that teenagers, college students, people who obviously have no recollection of it, but whose parents might not even have a record. They might have to go to their grandparents to ask about this, if that. But in the process of putting together excerpts from the letters that the leaders sent to each other during this period, especially during the crisis, we discovered for the first time something that we had never noticed before. So after the Bay of Pigs invasion, this begins on the 17th of April 1961, lasts 72 hours at the outside. Castro's militia wraps everybody up, takes them up to Havana, puts them on trial. It's over. Kennedy is humiliated and so forth. It's a great victory for the Cuban Revolution. Castro arrests 100,000 people on an island of 6.5 million, consolidates the revolution. The Bay of Pigs was a free gift. It was the greatest thing that ever happened to the revolution up to that point. But there's a dark side to this that somehow we missed. After all of these trips to Cuba that we made and all of our interviews with Castro and the others, what we never got was that Castro celebrated the victory, but at the same time he began speaking publicly about Cuba as a martyr nation. And Cuba has a long tradition of this, going back into the Spanish occupation. The Cuban historical figure that Fidel has always identified with is General Antonio Maceo, the great black general, who, when offered negotiating terms by the Spanish, repeatedly turned it down and made no compromise, no surrender, and finally he died fighting the Spanish. But it's this Cuban tradition of equating compromise with humiliation. We're going to get it all or we're not going to get any of it. That Fidel is right down the middle of that tradition. And he begins speaking on April 23rd, 1961, about the coming invasion and attack by the Americans, that we will arm every man, woman, and child. Now, the remarkable thing is Khrushchev wasn't listening and Kennedy wasn't listening. These are public statements made week after week after week. And from my point of view, if either of the leaders of the superpowers had been listening, we'd have had no crisis. If he thought he was putting missiles on an island full of people who thought they were getting ready for martyrdom, he would never have done it. In fact, once he realized it in the heart of the crisis, Khrushchev pulled those suckers out as fast as he could get them out. And if Kennedy had known that Castro thought the American invasion was inevitable, well, he'd have let him know it wasn't. He'd have pulled his ships back because Kennedy didn't want to deal with Cuba anymore. It was just a mess. He wanted to do arms control and comprehensive test ban and U.S.-Soviet relations. And this little, he called it a little pissant country. Cuba was equated with his humiliation at the Bay of Pigs. So we call it the sleepwalk. The superpowers are sleepwalking toward an abyss. They're having a good time jockeying with each other. They're moving around the pawns of the Cold War. And on this island are people who are waiting for the weapons, who are ready to ignite the war that could escalate to Armageddon.
Was it Khrushchev's idea to put missiles in Cuba?
Absolutely. After the Bay of Pigs, this is during the sleepwalk period, but after the Bay of Pigs, Khrushchev immediately realized that we have to save Cuba. I mean, that's how he saw it. We have to be a parent to this child. So they began shipping everything but nuclear weapons and the systems that would support them. I mean, just before the missile crisis, Cuba had become the second most heavily militarized piece of territory on Earth after North Korea. And it had started from nothing, from a standing start, absolute zero, to 43,000 Soviet troops and technicians, to 18 bases around the country, four of which were for the strategic weapons, and so forth. Now, the strategic missile thing comes in when Khrushchev is in Bulgaria in May of 1962. So the movement of troops and material is underway, and he takes a deep breath and thinks, you know, that probably won't be enough, because his intelligence is telling him that no matter what, how much stuff he pours into Cuba, by God, Kennedy is surrounding Cuba day by day by day. There are more ships, more planes, more troops. And in fact, in spite of Homestead Air Force Base being in South Florida, the Strategic Air Command was taking over parts of Miami International Airport because there were no place to put the B-52s. Why are the B-52s important? They carry nuclear bombs. That was the primary instrument of nuclear delivery in 1962 on the U.S. side were the B-52s. And Miami International Airport had nice, big, long runways. So he sends a delegation to suggest to the Cubans that maybe we might want to put some nuclear weapons in. And what do you think? And we talked to Fidel Castro about this for 4 days at one of these critical oral history conferences in 1992. And Fidel, this is sort of how it went. So they ask us, would you like nuclear missiles? And we think, did he ask us if we wanted nuclear missiles? Us? Sure. Yeah. Hell yes. Great. Except, do you understand, Soviet colleagues, comrades, do you understand that, I mean, we're already a target. We're a proven target. They already invaded us last year. I mean, we're really going to be a target now. Yes, we know. But we have a plan. The Russians say, we're going to do it in secret. We're going to basically lie through our teeth to everybody all over the world. We're not even going to tell our diplomats. And then in November, Khrushchev is going to come to Cuba. And guess what? Fidel and Nikita will stand in front of the Jose Marti monument and they will proclaim Cuba as a nuclear power and that the Americans dare not mess with Cuba. Furthermore, This is Khrushchev's thinking. This is also called delusional thinking. Kennedy's going to like it. He's really going to like it because then we can begin to negotiate arms control on a basis of equality. Now, that is so far from reality, it makes you wonder who he was getting his information from. And it's important to realize at this point, Bob, that Khrushchev is in sole power in the Kremlin. This is the very height of his power. He consults only in a kind of perfunctory way. Everybody goes in, everybody raises their hand, everybody goes out, and they do what Nikita wants. Probably he couldn't have done this earlier, and he certainly couldn't have done it later. But the Cubans are amazed. I mean, it's the ultimate compliment. I mean, we're the new guys on the block, and they know that the Soviet Union has never put nuclear missiles anywhere but the USSR.
I'm discussing the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis with Professor James Blight. After the break, we'll hear...
Well, to close out the show, and I hope you remember what I've said in the beginning, that these top world leaders lie and then put us all into danger, and usually the truth doesn't come out till decades later. And of course we'd all be dead if something didn't happen. So anyhow, that's leaderless resistance. you can have Obama or you can have Bush, give me my cell.
He says the 126 texts that he studied were all written in the period during or soon after the supposed existence of Jesus of Nazareth. And Polkovich, the historian, says that had this man existed, somebody surely would have heard of him or written something, you know, somebody as famous as Jesus, but there's no mention. Polkovich said, he writes in his synopsis of his research, he writes, quote, "When I considered those 126 writers, all of whom should have heard of Jesus but did not, and Paul and Marcion and Athenagoras and Matthew with a tetralogy of opposing Christs, the silence from Qumran and Nazareth and Bethlehem, conflicting Bible stories, and so many other mysteries and omissions, I must conclude that Jesus is a mythical character," end quote. He goes on to say that the Jesus of Nazareth was nothing more than an urban or desert legend, like an agglomeration of several evangelic and deluded rabbis who might have existed at the time. Of the writings that he examined, written from the first to third centuries, he found only one book that contained a mention of Jesus, and that was The Jewish Wars. That was a title by Roman historian Josephus Flavius. And that writer claims the whole story of Jesus was completely fabricated. We'll be right back. Claiming that Jesus of Nazareth was a mythical character and never existed, which, you know, would make sense. It doesn't diminish, I don't think, the what has been credited as being the words of this humanist philosopher rabbi from 2,000 years ago, but that's a whole different story. Polkovich, the researcher, says even in the Bible, Paul, who is often credited with spreading what would become Christianity, Paul, who wrote all his letters to the various populations in Syria and in Turkey during that time, that Paul never refers to Jesus as a real person. Polkovich writes, quote, "Paul is unaware of the Virgin Mother. He's ignorant of Jesus's nativity, his parentage, his life events, his ministry, his miracles, his apostles, his betrayal, his trial, and his harrowing passion." Paul knows neither where nor when Jesus lived, and considers the crucifixion metaphorical, end quote. Well, that's true. If you read Paul's letters to the Thessalonians, or Paul's letters to the Romans, or all the different books in the New Testament where Paul is writing to spread Christianity, you find that that's true. Polkovich also says that That silence from the Jesus character himself is telling, with no personal accounts being written. Palkovich says, quote, "Perhaps the most bewildering silent one is the mythical super savior himself, Jesus, the Son of God, ostensibly sent on a suicide mission to save us from the childish notion of Adam's transgression, as we learn from Romans, the book of Romans." He adds, "The Jesus character is a phantom of a wisp of a personage who never wrote anything." So add one more to Palkovich's list of writers who never mentioned Jesus, and that would be Jesus himself. He goes on, Palkovich, he writes, "Christian Father Marcion of Pontus in 144 CE denied any virgin birth or childhood for the Jesus infant. He says the circumcision of Jesus was a lie, as well as the crucifixion." And this was a Christian person, I guess. I guess that's what Michael Palkovich is writing here. He goes on to say, "Reading the works of second century Christian Father Athenagoras, one never encounters the word Jesus. Athenagoras was thus unacquainted with the name of his Savior, it would seem." End quote. Palkovich also claims even the book of Mark in the Bible, which contains the story of Jesus' resurrection, was doctored later after Mark wrote it. Palkovich says the original booklet, given the name Mark, ended at chapter 16, verse 8, and later forgers added the fanciful resurrection tale. He adds, "Millions have heard of the Jesus crucifixion with its astral enchantments, zombie armies, and meteorological marvels recorded not by any historian, but only in the dubitable scriptures scribbled decades later by superstitious yokels." Woo! Anyway, this guy, Michael Palkovich, his views surely will prove very controversial, it says here in the Mail Online, as most scholars do not support the theory that Jesus never existed. Most agree that he was a Galilean Jew born between 7 to 4 B.C., and who died in 30 to 36 A.D. It is also widely agreed that he was baptized by John the Baptist and crucified on the order of the Roman prefect Pontius Pilate. Now, can you imagine the condemnation that this historian, Michael Palkovich, is getting as a result of, what he considers to be his research? And if you go to the Mail Online, you can see the list of writers from that time. He lists them all, who never mentions Jesus of Nazareth or uses the celestial title Christ. It's just not there. And again, you know, you take it for what it's worth, but Palkovich makes a point. If there was somebody wandering around, some rabbi wandering around the Middle East 2,000 years ago, raising people from the dead and walking on the water and multiplying food for thousands of people sitting by the Sea of Galilee, and who you know, miraculously rises from the dead and so on and so forth, surely, somebody would have written about it. There had to have been an equivalent of a Wolf Blitzer all those years ago.